5:05 was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Tens of thousands of Yemenis gathered in the rebel-controlled capital Sana'a Sunday, marking the second anniversary of the intervention of the Saudi-led coalition on the side of the government forces against Houthi rebels. Saeed al-Hidari said, "Our will and resistance is more powerful than Saudi rockets, planes, and weapons." The conflict has left an estimated 10,000 dead and displaced millions more. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal said it's a struggle between rivals Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Yemen was being used as a playground or a battleground, whatever you want to call it, for the hegemonic control over Middle East between Iran and Saudi Arabia. It had turned into more of a religious factional war than anything else.
The Shia Houthis are backed by forces loyal to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh against the internationally recognized government of President Abu Mansur Hadi. The Houthis remain entrenched in most of northern Yemen. Several rounds of UN talks have failed to produce agreement. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame hailed his country's friendship with Israel Sunday during an address to the American Israel Public Affairs Committee Policy Conference in Washington.
For Rwanda and many other countries in Africa, engaging productively with Israel has opened new horizons. We look forward to doing even more together.
Mr. Kagame, the first African head of state to address the pro-Israel forum, he said the genocide both peoples experienced is a tragic shared history that brings the two countries closer together. This is VOA News. There are conflicting accounts about the cause of an explosion in the Iraqi city Mosul last week that killed as many as 200 civilians. It's unclear whether the massive March 17 blast that leveled buildings in western Mosul was caused by an Islamic State booby trap or a U.S. coalition airstrike. Brigadier General Matthew Isler is a deputy U.S. commander.
The coalition takes every feasible measure to protect civilians from harm. The coalition takes every allegation seriously and investigates all credible allegations.
The commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, General Joseph Votel, said the deaths of innocent civilians is a terrible tragedy, and the U.S. is investigating to determine exactly what happened. Iran announced Sunday it's imposing sanctions on 15 U.S. companies for supporting what it called Israel's terrorist actions in the occupied West Bank. The decision is largely symbolic since none of the firms cited does business with Tehran. Police across Russia detained hundreds of protesters Sunday, including opposition leader Alexei Navalny, after thousands demonstrated against corruption and demanded the resignation of Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev. This protester named Vladimir said if the prime minister is guilty, he should be punished, but he fears the courts are subject to the very same corruption. The Kremlin called the protests, which occurred in other cities, illegal and provocative. The U.S. Sunday criticized the arrests as an affront to democracy. A Ukrainian helicopter crashed in the east of the country Sunday, killing two crew members and three passengers. The Soviet-built Mi-2 crashed near Kramatorsk, headquarters of Ukrainian forces battling pro-Russian separatists. The cause of the crash appears to be striking a power line, but investigation is underway. Political factions in Northern Ireland have until Monday to form a new power-sharing government or risk returning to direct rule from London. Sinn Féin, the province's largest national party, said no substantive progress was made. It traded accusations with the pro-British Democratic Unionist Party for the collapse of the talks. Britain is trying to resolve the matter before negotiations to leave the European Union begin. President Donald Trump Sunday blamed congressional Republicans who formed the so-called Freedom Alliance for torpedoing a health insurance reform measure he backed but failed last week. In a tweet, Mr. Trump said Democrats are smiling that the Freedom Caucus, with the help of the Club of Growth and Heritage Foundation, saved Planned Parenthood and Obamacare. The bill was pulled before a vote could take place Friday. Thousands of Australians have been urged to evacuate from coastal communities in the path of powerful Cyclone Debbie as the storm approached the country's northeast. The winds are topping 300 kilometers per hour. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, March 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan government blames rebels for the killing of six aid workers over the weekend.
We condemn such act in the strongest terms possible because the relief workers were to deliver food to the needy people who are South Sudanese. So killing them is an act of terrorism.
Ateng Wek Ateng is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. But rebels loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar say they do not attack aid workers. Liberia's gender minister says Liberian women found their voices in large numbirs under President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. And African leaders of the IGAD regional grouping promised to help Somali refugees go back home.
Today, about 2.5 million Somali refugees and IDPs live in camps in and out of the country. Tragically, some have lived in the camps for three generations, all because the environment was not conducive enough in Somalia for them to return.
Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, Somalia's president, and an official of Amnesty International expresses concern over the lack of investigation days after violent student protests at Sierra Leone's Unjala University. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan's government has accused rebel loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar of killing six aid workers over the weekend. Ateng Wek Ateng, spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir, says the rebels are trying to drive a wedge between the government and the international community by committing what he called acts of terrorism. The UN mission in South Sudan says the aid workers belonging to a national non-governmental organization were killed as they traveled from Juba, the capital, to Pibor town in Jonglei State. It has called on the South Sudan government to investigate and bring to book those responsible. Wek Ateng says even though South Sudan is safe, it cannot stop people who are bent on committing acts of terrorism. He also said UN aid workers often refuse South Sudan military escorts.
We condemned such act in the strongest terms possible because this is a problem that is not South Sudanese completely, because the relief workers were to deliver food to the needy people who are South Sudanese. So killing them is an act of terrorism by those who have actually killed these humanitarian workers.
Yet, sir, this keeps happening to the point that I think the United Nations is saying that so far this year about 88 workers have been killed. So if you believe this is an act of terrorism and it's irresponsible, who is responsible? Who's doing it?
There's nobody who can do this apart from the rebels. The rebels can do this just in an attempt to drive the wedge between the government and the international community. Our soldiers cannot attack aid workers. So this is the work of rebels. We have been saying time and again that the pockets of rebels that are operating in South Sudan have now moved to commit crimes similar to that are actually committed by ISIS and another terrorist organization like Boko Haram. So there's no doubt about that.
The last time we talked, you also blamed the rebels. And so this begs the question whether your country is losing control to the rebels. Because if this keeps happening, are you in control?
No, we are in control. You know, what is happening is that, you know, there are isolated areas that the pocket of rebels are operating between roads, you know, like you have heard, you know, several times that even the civilian targets coming from, you know, Uganda via Lomami or from Yei, you know, to Juba, there have been sporadic attacks by the rebel against the civilian target. So there are rebels who actually take the advantage, the security lapses, and cause havoc. It doesn't mean that we don't control the country. We control the country, but as I told you earlier, that, you know, because of national dialogue, our army is not, you know, on operation, because we are waiting for the national dialogue to gather momentum, and we are giving chance to the people to respond to a national dialogue. And you know this, you know, when there is a humanitarian, you know, convoy that is moving, they refuse our escort, they refuse our army to escort, you know, the United Nations vehicles. And by taking it alone, something of that kind can happen. It doesn't mean that the government doesn't control.
What do you make of what the special representative of the UN Secretary General for South Sudan, Mr. David Shearer, saying that the latest attacks in South Sudan occur in areas controlled by your government?
That's not true at all. You know, even if the areas are controlled, you know, individuals, rebels, three or four, operating using guerrilla warfare cannot be prevented. No country in the world that has prevented anybody using guerrilla tactics, hit and run. No country has controlled this. United Nations has 12,000 forces in South Sudan, but they didn't manage themselves to do this. If they were to do it, even if they don't do it for the whole South Sudanese, they should have done to protect their convoy. But if they have not done, the United Nations special envoy cannot accuse the government. I mean, he wanted the government to be anywhere at any time.
So is the South Sudan government willing to investigate this latest attack and all other attacks and do it independently?
Yeah, of course. As a responsible government, we have to investigate and find exactly what has happened and also know the circumstances in which the attack happened and how many people have been killed.
Ateng Wekateng is spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. The Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition, SPLAIO, rebels loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar, are denying as complete lies government claims that they were behind Saturday's ambush that killed six aid workers. The UN mission in South Sudan says the aid workers belonging to a national non-governmental organization were killed as they traveled from Juba to Bipor town in Jonglei State. Lieutenant Colonel Lamb Paul Gabriel, deputy SPLAIO military spokesman, says the area where the incident took place is under the control of the government and its militia groups. Besides, he says, the rebels do not attack aid workers because aid workers have been providing assistance to civilians in liberated areas. Lieutenant Colonel Gabriel says the government is engaged in propaganda because it wants to discourage aid agencies from helping people in rebel-controlled areas.
Our group does not exist in that area. The location there is under the full control of the government forces and their militias. Not under our own control. We never reached there. We have not even reached that area yet.
But this does not mean that your group have not been involved in attacking aid workers. Have you been attacking aid workers? Because this has been going on into the fact that the United Nations says about 80 aid workers have been killed so far.
We don't attack aid workers. Aid workers have been helping the community under our control in the liberated areas. They have been giving food, medicine, and many other items like agricultural production. They make a lot of services in our own area. Now, why should we attack people who are helping the community? The government is just making this propaganda because they want to stop these aid workers from coming to our area and offering these services. They have always targeted the aid workers, and at the end, they blame it on us. But the truth is, even the UNHCR knows that. Even these aid agencies, they know very well that we don't attack aid workers. We get them, we make sure that okay, we protect them. In our areas, we always protect the aid workers. It's just a complete lie from the government.
The last time the news was that your group was holding certain people and wanted some ransom. Do you seek ransom for people you might be holding?
No, we never seek any ransom for anybody. The last time we held people, especially aid agency, was not really what they call holding. It was after attack in Mayendi. That was around the 15th of this month. The government attacked our position. We pushed them back. And in the process, these aid workers agencies belonging to certain NGO, they ran in disarray. So on our way back, we found them. We collected them and brought to our area. The next day, they were handed over to the WAP, and they were taken back to the organization where they work. The second incident is here with the issue of the oil workers. The oil workers, there are two Indians and one Pakistani. These people are still with us because our area is not accessible to the government and we cannot release it to the government straight away. We made it very clear. We do not want this oil to be used. We don't want it to be accessed. We don't want whether the government, whether it is the organization, whether it is a company, going to the oil because this oil is being used to fund this war. They continue fighting. They continue killing civilians instead of helping the people. People are starving. People are dying every single day, but they use that oil to make sure they purchase his ammunition and attack our forces and attack the civilians. So we want to make it very clear that oil facility is a no-go zone for anybody.
Lieutenant Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel is the deputy military spokesman for the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. He said he was speaking with me from the Ugandan South Sudan border. Today is Monday, March 27th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. The leaders of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, known as IGAD Regional Grouping, agreed on Saturday at their meeting in Nairobi, Kenya, to facilitate the voluntary return of Somali refugees. As Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, the leaders also agreed to address the political and security situation in Somalia.
Eight leaders from Eastern Africa met in Nairobi to discuss the situation of Somali refugees in the region. The meeting was held 2 months before the planned Dadaab refugee camp closure by the Kenyan government. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta insists the refugee camp in the northeast part of his country is no longer just a sanctuary for refugees, but is the scene of criminal and terror activities too.
Instead, the Dadaab has become a protracted situation characterized by hopelessness that easily feeds environmental destruction, conflicts between refugees and host communities, insecurity, radicalization, criminality, and also allows terrorist operatives to exploit it for their operational efforts.
More than 200,000 refugees live in the Dadaab refugee camp. Close to 1 million Somalis are refugees in neighboring countries. Kenya hosts a third of those, and Ethiopia is home to 250,000 of Somalis. The region is also facing a humanitarian crisis. More than 17 million are affected by drought and are in need of aid assistance. The leaders said there was a need to respond to the humanitarian crisis to prevent new displacement of people. Observers fear the current crisis may threaten the lives of refugees returning to Somalia, where 6 million, half of the population, is hungry. The heads of the nations in the summit said that voluntary repatriation is not the only option, and has urged other countries to come forward and share responsibility through settling some of the refugees in third countries. Somali President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed says his compatriots tell him the situation back at home has forced them to leave in camps.
Today, about 2.5 million Somali refugees and IDPs live in camps in and out of the country. Tragically, some have lived in the camps for three generations, all because the environment was not conducive enough in Somalia for them to return.
Mohamed says his government will call on the rest of the nations in the region to improve the security situation.
We will increase our effort to jointly achieve the objectives of this conference on the voluntary return of our people in a safe and dignified manner, and to provide durable solutions so that they can participate in the rebuilding of prosperous and peaceful Somalia at peace and harmony with itself and its neighbors.
Kenya, Uganda, Djibouti, Burundi, and Ethiopia have sent troops to Somalia to support the government and fight Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. UNHCR's Assistant High Commissioner for Operations, George Obo, says creating a safe place for refugees will require a collective effort.
Solutions for refugees and the internal displaced are, however, fundamentally linked to resolving conflict and building stability inside Somalia. But these should not be pursued as sequential steps. Rather, we need to engage a range of tools and actors to help build the conditions that will allow those refugees who are ready to return home to do so voluntarily.
The UN's refugee agency is calling for a joint effort to mitigate the effect of drought and avert famine in the region, to reduce the suffering of the population in Eastern Africa. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Liberia's Minister of Gender and Development says Liberian women found their voices in large numbers during President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf 2 terms in office as Africa's first elected female president. But Julia Duncan Cassell says there is a need for affirmative action in Liberia, where she says the legislature is dominated by men. She says she's running for a seat in the 2017 general election to increase the number of women in parliament from the current level of 15. Duncan Cassell was in Washington last week after attending this year's Status of Women Conference in New York. She told me President Sirleaf's first couple of years in office were difficult, especially working with the domestic parliament and foreign governments dominated by men.
Africa, one of the largest continent in the world, one of the oldest. For the first time, a woman becoming president on her continent. Her first couple of years was difficult working with her male counterparts. not having to deal with women as first ladies or vice president, but this time around they had to deal with a woman as president. But our president, Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, has stood the test of time.
Are you suggesting, Madam Minister, that perhaps because President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is a woman, that there were some difficulties in her tenure as president, perhaps from the men? Are you suggesting that?
No, what I'm saying to you is that looking at where Liberia came from, so many years of civil crisis, so many years of interim government, coming down to an elected government, of course the challenges was high, the expectation was high, and the standard that was set for her was very, very high. But not only just being a woman, but a woman with vision, a woman with passion.
I want to ask you, because when the president came to power, then there was this talk of fighting violence against women, education for girls. Give me a status report in terms of what has happened.
Well, yes, because now a lot of girls, like she said in her annual message in January, that what really touches her when she walks into a classroom and a little girl can say to the teacher, you know, don't talk to me like that, because I could be the next president of Liberia. So she has given a lot of young girls hope that they too can be the next president. They too can be the next minister. They too can be anything. So girls' enrollment in school has increased. And not just being in school, but if you look at the WAEC, the West African exam results, you will see that more girls now are passing and they are competing with boys. What she has also done in terms of domestic violence, with rape, abuse, neglect, she has engaged people from the community level. Through her, the rape law was passed.
So I want to ask you about the affirmative action. First of all, what's the status of that? And does the president believe in quota for women?
Let me take it back, James. You know, the president is one person, but you have three branches of government. You have the judiciary and you have the legislature. The president, along with the executive, sent proposed bill. But if you don't have enough people believing in that bill in the legislature, those bills tend to linger there. And that's what is happening now to the affirmative bill, because you have more men than women. And the men are saying, why are women seeking for affirmative action? And all we are seeing in Liberia for an affirmative action bill is that give the women a chance. Mm-hmm. You see why Rwanda is developing fast? Because women are at the helm of every level of decision-making in their country. The affirmative action is to give women more seats there to be able to compete with their male counterpart. And in decision-making, you cannot discuss issues pertaining to women, the youth, and people living with disability if they're not at the decision-making table.
So is Minister Duncan Cassell running for office this year?
It is my intent to run for office this year in Electoral District 3 in Grand Bassa County, yes. But we are also encouraging a lot of other women. Like I said to you, there are 73 seats up for grabs. Currently, we have 143 female aspirants, female that are interested, you know. And sometimes you have in one district 10, 11, 12 men. And people say, but why are all these women running? Why can't you have 10, 11, 12 women running the same district? But at least at the end of the day, we want to see a woman winning in her seat.
Julia Duncan Cassell is Liberia's Minister of Gender and Development. She was speaking with me here in Washington, D.C. One person was killed and two seriously injured after security forces opened fire on student protesters in Bo, Sierra Leone, late last week. Still, no investigation is underway, according to Amnesty International. Amnesty's West Africa researcher Sabrina Martini tells Ricky Schreier that in addition to the death in Bo, 14 students in the capital have been sentenced to 3 months in prison for participating in the protest.
To my knowledge, there's been no action by the government regarding this killing and the injuries. We haven't heard anything that, you know, a public inquiry is going to be set up. And so this is something we're really calling on the government to do. Sierra Leone also has a newly constituted Independent Police Complaints Commission. So they are, you know, the right body to really look into this. But unfortunately, we have seen, you know, in the past that this is something that has happened quite commonly in Sierra Leone. So last year, similarly, some youth were protesting about a youth centre being moved in Kabila, and two were shot dead. And nothing has happened since then. The Independent Police Commission did look into that, but their report hasn't been made public and no action has been taken, no arrests have been made. So this is a concerning pattern in Sierra Leone. And with the election coming up in March next year, of course, you know, people will want to rally, to exercise their rights to peaceful assembly. And this trend of excessive violence enforced by the security forces is really concerning.
How concerning is this, I guess, on the broader scale? Is it a worry now that the youth, and especially it seems to happen a lot when the youth are protesting things that are happening to them, is it a worry that they're not actually able to exercise their right to freely protest?
Absolutely. I mean, I've spoken to people in Sierra Leone who feel nervous to go out to the streets because they've repeatedly heard for several years that, you know, when people go out, there's always violence, that, you know, people die, people are injured. And so people I've spoken to are reluctant. We have heard that the government, you know, is actually engaging with the university, and actually Njala University may open next week.
That was Sabrina Mateni, West Africa researcher for Amnesty International. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, James. We begin with the IWAF World Championships Kampala 2017, where Uganda's Jacob Kiplimo produced a performance of a lifetime in front of thousands of cheering home fans to write history, fending off a challenge from Ethiopian and Kenyan rivals to win gold in the men's under-20 race, the country's first ever gold medal at a World Cross Country Championship. Kiplimo covered the 8-kilometer course in 22 minutes, 4.0 seconds, ending the Kenyan and Ethiopian dominance in the event to win the first global title of his career. But it was Kenya who dominated the World Cross Country Championships on Sunday as Geoffrey Kamawuru defended his men's title, winning in a time of 28 minutes, 2.4 seconds, making him the first back-to-back winner since 2006. In the women's category, Irene Chepet Cheptai led a mighty Kenyan women's squad to the first ever top six sweep at the World Cross Country Championships. Irene Cheptai, who was seventh at the World Championships in Guiyang 2 years ago, clocked 31 minutes, 5.7 seconds around the 10-kilometer course. The silver went to Alice Nawuwuna and bronze to Lilian Renguk. Kenyan athletes also powered home to victory in the first ever organized mixed relay race as Team Kenya secured the nation's first gold after clocking an impressive 22 minutes 22 seconds on Sunday at the Kololo Independence Grounds, which was the venue for the IWAF World Cross Country Championships. The Kenyan team was 8 seconds better over their East African rivals, Ethiopia. The new event comprised of 2 men and 2 women, with each running a loop of the course. More than 550 athletes from 59 countries took part in the IWAF World Championships Kampala 2017. Staying with athletics news, the IWAF president Sebastian Coe says distance running should be viewed as an important part of an athlete's developmental process. Speaking at the sidelines of the 2017 IWAF World Championships in Kampala on Sunday, the IWAF president is, however, concerned with the continued withdrawal of teams from international competitions. On Frank Fredericks, the IWAF president announced that the IOC member has temporarily stepped aside from his duties on the IWAF council pending the result of an ethics investigation. The Namibian is being investigated by the IOC ethics panel regarding an alleged payment he received from a now-banned athletics official before the 2016 Olympics game, which was awarded to Rio de Janeiro. In squash news, Egyptian squash star and world number one Noah El Shabini lost to world number five Laura Massaro 3-2 in the semi-final of the Alam British Open's women contest on Saturday. Massaro of England came from behind to beat defending champion El Shabini 3-2 in 63 minutes. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, March 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very productive week.
Next on Let's Talk. What do women want in a relationship? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests chatting about women and relationships. Let's Talk comes to you Monday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.